Hello and welcome to another episode of Common Room Philosophy. I'm your host, Toby Tremlett. Today I'm interviewing Warwick Philosophy's Samir Bijaj, a political philosopher whose work centres on issues of democracy and the duties of democratic citizens. This interview is split into two parts, with the first part focusing on Samir's journey into philosophy, his opinions about why political philosophy is important, and whether the US and the UK could really be called democratic. The second part will focus on more theoretical issues, such as the biggest theoretical challenges to democracy, why we should vote in the face of our causal insignificance, and what constitutes a justified protest. So without any further ado, welcome to the podcast, Samir.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
No problem. So for our first question, was there a book or an experience that first drew you to philosophy?
Well, you know, a lot of philosophers, when asked this question, say that they're fascinated or were fascinated by philosophical questions or proto-philosophical questions, even as young children. So questions like, does God exist or is morality objective? So I can't say I was in the grip of these sorts of philosophical questions. I was in the grip of certain moral convictions, actually. So if you can't tell from my accent, I'm American. I was born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama, which, as you may know, was in many ways the heart of the American civil rights movement. And I can remember learning about the civil rights movement and developing these deep convictions in the fundamental moral equality of all human beings and, you know, the power of democratic social movements. And so I carried those convictions with me for a while till I got to university. I went to university in Pomona College in Southern California. And I started out thinking I'd be an English major, and that didn't quite work out. But then I took a course spring term of my sophomore year with Professor Paul Hurley, Introduction to Social and Political Philosophy. And that's really what did it. So it was a really beautiful and powerful experience, illuminating the foundations of these convictions I'd had for a very long time. Yeah, I was really hooked by the social contract tradition at first. Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and Rawls. And yeah, I fell hard after that.
Did any of that make you question your convictions, or was it more that it provided a grounding to things you already believed?
I think it was more that it provided a grounding. It shed light on the underlying structure of the convictions. I mean, I don't think at any point I ever questioned the fundamental moral equality of human beings. But what that course did and what the other courses I took did were to show me that these convictions were grounded in a much deeper structure. And if drawn out to its ultimate conclusions, this philosophical structure has implications for all sorts of political questions about how we ought to arrange our economies and how we ought to arrange systems of government and what the nature of our political rights is and what the role of the law and the courts is. And but I don't think at any point that I was made to question these kind of fundamental moral convictions. I mean, there are people in the history of political philosophy who have questioned the fundamental moral equality of all individuals, but I never at any point was led seriously to think that those arguments were convincing or right. You know, to say that individuals are fundamentally morally equal leaves open so many questions.
Definitely.
Right, and so that's where all of the action is, I think, and that was all of that action is what drew me to political philosophy.
So if that was a book, I would have said, would you recommend that book? But since it was a module, would you recommend studying political philosophy?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I would recommend studying political philosophy first and foremost for the same reason I would recommend studying any philosophy, which is that it illuminates the truth about issues of fundamental importance to the human condition. So for anyone who is interested in living in the light of the truth, I would recommend studying political philosophy. Of course, there are all sorts of different truths. There's scientific truths, there's mathematical truths, there's the truths of history and economics. So, you know, maybe people are interested in other kinds of truths, or maybe people are not so interested in abstract truth, but interested in creating beautiful art or making money, starting a business. You know, there's all sorts of things people can do with their time, and political philosophy is only one of those things. But to anyone who's gripped by the questions that political philosophers ask, I would think, absolutely. I mean, in addition to that, I think every democratic citizen should have some familiarity with the foundational texts of political philosophy. I think it makes you a better, more informed citizen, someone who's aware of the deeper principles and foundations that animate our structure of government. So I think everyone should have some familiarity with political philosophy. Yeah, absolutely.
What are those texts that you mentioned there? What would you say, you know, the text everyone should be somewhat familiar with?
So I think every democratic citizen should have some familiarity with Plato's Republic. Obviously, Plato, not a fan of democracy, but nevertheless has been incredibly important and influential in political philosophy. And it's good for democratic citizens to have some familiarity with advanced criticisms of democracy. We shouldn't just take democracy as a given, and Plato's a great place to start in terms of critics of democracy. Then I think the core social contract theorists, so Hobbes, Leviathan, obviously, again, Hobbes is not a fan of democracy, but the social contract methodology has been extremely influential in contemporary political thought, and he is the founder of the social contract tradition. Then Locke, I mean, there's a lot of things you can read in Locke, but obviously Second Treatise of Government is really the major work in terms of thinking about liberal democracy. Rousseau, obviously, Discourse on Inequality and the Social Contract. Obviously, Rousseau is a fan of democracy, a fan of a very robust form of democratic socialism. He has been extremely influential, and I think every democratic citizen should have some familiarity with his work. Then I would say On Liberty by Mill, not a direct defense of democracy per se, but a defense of liberalism, of freedom of thought and expression. And since most of the major democracies in the world are liberal democracies, and there is this question of how we balance strong individual freedoms against collective rule, Mill's On Liberty, I think, is a great place to start to think about these questions. And then moving to the 20th century, I think A Theory of Justice by Rawls. It's more difficult than all of the texts I've just mentioned. It's more advanced. But at least the first few chapters, I think most educated readers could at least understand some of the basics and some of the basic framework. So those are the core, what I think of as the foundational texts of democratic theory. But you also mentioned texts that a democratic citizen should read. And I think democratic citizens should read more than these texts. I think they should read the best stuff currently out there in contemporary political philosophy. So I'm looking at my bookshelf now and just thinking about which of these books democratic citizens should read. Definitely Tommy Shelby's Dark Ghettos, published, I think, in 2016. It's a philosophical analysis of American ghettos, and more generally, it explores questions of what kind of agency we can expect of victims of injustice. I think a very important set of questions. Margaret Walker's Moral Repair, which is not specifically a work in democratic theory or even a work in political philosophy, but it's about the question of how we restore moral relationships after very serious wrongdoing. So obviously, it's a question of first-rate importance in democratic theory, even though that book itself, Moral Repair, is not
specifically a work in democratic theory. It's a more general work. Liz Anderson's The Imperative of Integration, which I think is, in contemporary political philosophy, really one of the best works in terms of blending empirical social science with normative philosophical analysis. Daniel Allen's Talking to Strangers, which is a really interesting work. The stuff that interests me in that book is sort of about the kind of radical vulnerability democratic citizens have to the agency of other citizens. We're subject to the coercive political power of collective self-rule and what kind of responsibilities that brings up. Julia Maskivker's The Duty to Vote, which is, as you can imagine, about the duty to vote, and it's an attempt to ground a duty of individual democratic citizens to vote. Helene Landemore's Democratic Reason, which is a very interesting book applying social scientific models to attempt to show that we can expect democracies to produce better decisions than rivals because democracies are best able to exploit the underlying diversity of large-scale populations. Candace Delmas's A Duty to Resist, which is about the duty to resist injustice. I've got to give a shout-out to Gerald Gauss's The Order of Public Reason. Jerry Gauss was one of my old professors at the University of Arizona and just passed away at the end of last month prematurely, but he was a great thinker. And that book, The Order of Public Reason, incredible book about the evolution of moral norms and about the moral sentiments. Just a very wide-ranging, very deep and sophisticated work. And then finally, a book that's not, again, directly about democratic theory, but I think has a lot of applications to democratic theory is Liam Murphy's The Moral Demands in Non-Ideal Theory, which is really about, directly about, duties we have to alleviate poverty and suffering around the world. What kind of duties affluent individuals have to eliminate poverty around the world. But the framework he lays out, I think, is an interesting and powerful framework for thinking about collective action problems more generally and about the duties of individuals to contribute to large-scale collective efforts, which I think is highly relevant to democratic theory. So those were a lot of books. I wouldn't expect any democratic citizen to sit down and just read all of those books at one time, but maybe over the course of several years. A democratic citizen who read all of those books, I think, would have a much greater understanding of democracy and of their role in democratic systems.
So another question about your interest in philosophy. How have your philosophical interests evolved over time? Have you found that, you know, since that one module, you've been pretty one track, or have there been broad interests?
I think I've always been interested in political philosophy. That I always knew that if I was going to pursue philosophy as a profession, that it would be primarily in political philosophy. I am interested in deeper questions in ethical theory and moral theory, but my home base is in political philosophy. So that interest has been enduring. My interest in political philosophy have changed. I think, as I was saying, you know, I really started out with this strong interest in the social contract tradition. And really the thinker that I used to focus the most on was John Rawls and the work of the later John Rawls. I started my PhD program with really a strong interest in methodological issues and meta-ethical issues coming out of the work of the later John Rawls. So methodological issues concerning how idealistic political philosophy should be. Should political philosophy aim to articulate a vision of a perfectly utopian society, or should it be concerned with providing practical recommendations grounded in facts on the ground as we see them in the real world? So this is sometimes known as the ideal theory, non-ideal theory debate. And also meta-ethical questions, related meta-ethical questions concerning the role of truth in political philosophy. Of course, in a democratic society, citizens disagree about moral and philosophical truth, about what a good life consists in, about
whether God exists, and if God exists, what God says about morality. So there is an important debate, not just centered in the work of Rawls, but he's a central figure in this debate about the proper role of truth in political theorizing. And I think these are still important questions, but my interests have shifted a little bit more to what I would broadly call the moral demands of democratic citizenship. How and why should democratic citizens participate in politics? Yeah, my interests were moving in this direction for several years, and quite frankly, the election of Donald Trump, I think, hastened my turn towards these questions. It made these questions even more urgent.
So I think we've kind of covered some of the questions that I wanted to ask about political philosophy, but maybe there's one remaining in what do you think the value is of political philosophy being studied in general? So in universities, having researchers studying political philosophy, what is the, yeah, what is the value of that?
Yeah, well, I think any civilized society needs individuals who are concerned with truth for the sake of truth. Now, there's, you know, all kinds of unimportant truths. I'm staring at my lawn outside of my window, and there is a truth about how many blades of grass are on that lawn. And I don't think universities should devote a bunch of resources to determining how many blades of grass are on my lawn. So I do think, you know, to be a little bit more precise, I think any civilized society should have people who are concerned with studying important truths for the sake of important truths. And so why is political philosophy, why are the truths with which political philosophy is concerned, why are they important truths? Well, you know, questions about what form of government we should have, about the nature of citizenship, justice, protest, authority. I mean, these are things that structure our lives in real and pervasive manners. Because of that, I think they are important truths, and they should be studied. And they're not obvious truths. I mean, it may seem obvious now, for example, that we should have democratic systems of government, but that's not always been obvious. And I think if you look deeply at the criticisms of democracy, you will see that there are good arguments against democratic systems of government, just to give an example of a seemingly obvious truth. And now, ultimately, I think we should have democratic systems of government, but the explanation of why we should is not obvious. So I think first and foremost, we should have political philosophy and study political philosophy because it's concerned with truths of fundamental importance. And well, at least I want to have those truths illuminated. I want to live in the truth. And I think many people do. But it's also the case that, you know, although political philosophy as it's studied is really abstract, these abstract truths do trickle down over time to the public in general. And that's a long process. But, you know, just to take an example, the founders of the United States, the framers of the United States Constitution, I mean, they weren't particularly original thinkers. They were drawing on political philosophy. In that way, political philosophy just structures at an extremely fundamental level the entire system of government in the United States. And that's true of different places also. So that's a second reason to study political philosophy, is that it actually structures the world as we know it. And a third reason is, as democratic citizens, as I was saying before, we should want to know the unifying principles that our system of government should be structured by, so that when it time goes, you know, when it's time to enter the voting booth, we know who to vote for. We're not just led by these disparate convictions that are unconnected. We have a sense of what the proper principles of political morality are. And you don't have to have a PhD to know that. You can study political philosophy at
a more accessible level. And I think every democratic citizen should. So those are just a few reasons, I think, why political philosophy is important.
Yeah, so I think it'd be great for us to talk a little bit more about democracy and the theory of democracy, and then to talk later on about the duties that democratic citizens have.
Yes.
So a lot of your academic work, as well as your module coming up next term called Democracy and Authority, focuses around this political system we call democracy. So firstly, how would you define democracy, and what features must hold for a country to be a democracy?
Well, that's a difficult question. So let me just say very generally, I think democracy, we need some general way of characterizing democracy just to know what we're theorizing about as democratic theorists. And so I think democracy refers very generally to a system of group decision making that's characterized by political equality at some essential stage of the collective decision making process. So the relevant form of equality can be more or less robust, but generally speaking, a democracy is going to involve adherence to the principle of one person, one vote at some essential stage of the decision-making process. So I think the best way to think of this is not to think, you know, what are the defining features of democracy, but to think of it as a scale. Let's say on the far left-hand side of the scale, you have pure direct democracy, where citizens vote directly on the laws that govern them, and every law that governs them. A little bit further to the right, you have representative democracy, where citizens vote for representatives who vote for the laws that govern citizens. Now, that introduces some significant degree of political inequality because you're concentrating power in the hands of a few, namely the representatives. But because we vote for the representatives, it makes sense, I think, to think of it as a form of democracy still. Then you get a little bit further to the right of the scale and you have an oligarchy where power is concentrated in the hands of a few. Now, how we decide who the few are, that's tricky. Maybe the few are appointed in terms of their wealth, maybe in terms of their expertise, maybe it's hereditary. But nevertheless, although power is more widely diffused, it's certainly less democratic than a pure direct democracy or a representative democracy because, let's stipulate, the few are not appointed in terms of who votes them into power. Mm. There's some other criterion for appointing the few. And then on the furthest right-hand side of the scale, you have, let's say, a pure absolute dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And so I think rather than thinking what are the constitutive features of democracy, we can just ask how democratic is a particular system of government on this left to right scale. And there's all sorts of different points in between these very general points I've identified. You know, if you concentrate power in the hands of an unelected judiciary, for example, to what extent does that, you know, make a system of government less democratic? But nevertheless, I think the right way to think of things is in terms of how democratic a system of government is on a scale, as opposed to asking what are the constitutive features of democracy. But at the most general level, just to reiterate, I think what distinguishes democracy from, you know, what distinguishes systems that are more democratic from systems that are less democratic is the extent to which they adhere to the principle of one person, one vote, to the principle of political equality at an essential stage of the decision-making process.
Mm, okay. Do you have an idea of where the UK might be on that scale?
Mm. Well, that's a good question. I think it's a representative democracy. And a fairly robust representative democracy. So the most recent Freedom House survey gives the UK a 39 out of 40 for the most recent year in terms of the protection of citizens' democratic rights. Mm. I think one point was deducted when Boris Johnson suspended Parliament. You know, that was an anti-democratic threat. And so Yeah, I think the UK is a fairly robust representative democracy. It's certainly more robust than the United States. Mm-hmm. If we use this general characterization of democracy that I just offered, where it's a system of government characterized by political equality at some essential stage of the decision-making process, certainly it adheres more strictly to the principle of political equality than the United States mm-hmm. does. Mm-hmm. I mean, the United States, there's all sorts of reasons why it's a deeply unequal form of democracy. Obviously, the influence of money in politics is preposterous. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever influence money has in politics here, it certainly has far less of an influence than it does in the United States for all sorts of reasons. And so because of the role of this, you know, the all-encompassing role of campaigns and the way in which money enters into politics, which we can talk about if you'd like to, in the United States, basically what happens is you get politicians whose one and only concern is to acquire as much money as they can in order to get reelected. And that allows for wealthy people to wield an enormous and inordinate influence over American politics, which introduces a very deep form of inequality right at the beginning of any campaign. And there's also other kinds of inequality, voter suppression and disenfranchisement, the massive expansion of executive power and the enormous power of the United States Supreme Court. So I started talking about the United States, sorry, in response to the question. The reason it's relevant is you hear the complaint sometimes that, you know, the UK is not a very robust form of democracy. Mm-hmm. But I think it is a fairly robust form of representative democracy. The ways in which it's not as robust as it might be, obviously, it's legally a constitutional monarchy. Mm-hmm. So the head of state is hereditary, not elected. Now, the power to create legislation rests solely with Parliament. So it's not obvious how anti-democratic it is from that standpoint to have a hereditary head of state. My understanding is that the monarchy has some discretion over the use of public funds, at least sometimes, and that's kind of anti-democratic. But, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know whether we want to suggest that undermines the status of the UK as a representative democracy. Mm-hmm. Of course, it is a representative democracy, too. It's not a pure form of direct democracy. So that's another way in which it's less democratic in which it might be than it might be. And more generally, this is a problem with democracies in the modern complex world. There's the expansion of the administrative state, the unelected administrative state, and unelected judges. But that's, relatively speaking, you know, many countries have that problem. And so relatively speaking, I think the UK remains a fairly robust representative democracy. Sure.
For our last question on this section about, you know, concrete democracies, what would you say would be one thing you could change to make the US more democratic?
Oh, there's so much.
yeah.
Just to reiterate what I was talking about before, I think money has a really unequalizing influence on American politics. So, as you may know, the United States Supreme Court, in a very famous decision, 2010 decision, I believe, Citizens United, rendered the ruling that although it was constitutional to put limits on the amount that private citizens could contribute directly to campaigns, it was an unconstitutional violation of free speech to limit the amount that citizens could spend on behalf of campaigns. So as long as citizens aren't contributing directly, giving money to a campaign, they can spend as much money as they want on behalf of campaigns. This allows for the creation of so-called super PACs that are corporations effectively that aggregate private citizen donations and spend on ads on behalf of campaigns. And this allows for wealthy citizens to wield a really extraordinary influence over
American politics. Citizens can effectively buy campaigns. And of course, there's an incredible amount of lobbying that happens on behalf of unions and private corporations that is built on the idea that citizens or private corporations won't spend on behalf of campaigns unless they get what they want. So candidates and officials are beholden. They are accountable to moneyed interests. And so, you know, I hesitate to say that's the thing that American politics could fix to make American politics more egalitarian. But that's one thing, and that's a thing that really sticks out.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Common Room Philosophy. The second part of this episode, focusing on more theoretical issues in democracy, will be out a week after this episode.